This is session one, take two, of an interview with the Reverend Billy Pate for the California State College Bakersfield California Odyssey Project by Michael Neely at 1613 Ida Street, Dos Palos, California, 93620, on March 5, 1981, at 9 o'clock a.m. Well, let's go back and one thing that interests me is what kind of effect we're talking about your experiences in school and having a difficult time with the one teacher in particular, but how did this affect your mother, having been a member of a community and a good person, a good member of the community in Texas, and coming out here and being poor and being a migrant? How did that affect your mother?
Well, I think it affected her greatly, in that she took great pride in her children. And then to see her children, or to feel that her children were being abused, would greatly upset my mother.
Well, now, she was fairly educated herself.
Yes. For that time, she was. But to think that her children, and I think perhaps my mother overcompensated to this degree, that perhaps her children could do no wrong. And I'm sure she overprotected us in that respect. But yet, I think she really showed great wisdom when her children were being abused. She felt they were being abused, to take them out of a school and provide an alternative for her kids to go to another school, even costing money that she didn't have. But yet, she was willing to sacrifice this to buy gas and to pay for a car, that her kids could go to a school that she felt they could get a better shake.
Did she feel that people looked down on her personally as well?
No. For this reason, you know, we lived at Lion Hoag, and this was a permanent type camp. People lived there the year round. At Hammonds, it was really more of a migrant camp. They would come and go. Lion Hoag, there were few houses and cabins there where people lived the year round. And all of these people were from the same area, Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. So we came to California from Texas, but yet for the next several years, our environment was still people from the South and so forth.
See, in essence, you created a new community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and my mother felt okay in this community because they were our kind of people, if I can use that.
Right. She felt comfortable there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What kind of social activities did you engage in, did the community engage in? What did they do for recreation?
Very little. Very, very little. My wife was asking me about this recently. And as a family, we had almost no recreation. And then as a community, there was, once in a great while, they would get together with their instruments, maybe a guitar or whatever, and sing a little bit. Or they'd have a little dance.
Why is that? Why was it so seldom?
Well, one thing now, and this developed with my father not long after we came out here. My father had always drank to some degree, you know, a little bit. Because in East Texas, they made their home brew because they couldn't buy it. They made it. Then we came to California, and things were tough, and my dad did work awfully hard. So he drank. He occasionally, well, more often than occasionally, pretty often, when he had a few extra dollars, he would drink. And the men at the camp drank. This was their recreation, or this is the way they dulled their senses. Because of the hard times, they drank.
So it might have been possible for an outside person to come in and think that they were all alcoholics or all drunks if they saw them at a particular time.
Oh, very easily, very easily. And well, I guess today they would be classified as alcoholics. They would be called weekend alcoholics or monthly alcoholics, because the men, practically all the men that I grew up with did this.
It was an escape?
Oh, definitely, definitely.
What did the women do for an escape?
Work.
Did your mother make quilts, anything like that?
Yes, she could quilt. Very self-sufficient, and I know she'd make her own soap and these things, you know, to render the fat, the lard, and make soap. My mother had a hard life, real hard, with four kids and working in the fields. She worked in the fields every day that there was work to be done. And then to take care of her children, laundry. This was always one of my jobs, was to be helping mother with the laundry. We'd go out and build a fire under the pot and heat the water and rub board, the old rubbing board. I can remember that so well. Then we'd been in California a couple of 3 years, and my mother was able to get a washing machine, the old agitator type. And this was a godsend, because my mother, after working so hard and then to bend over a scrub board to wash the clothes and cook the food and clean the house, it was a big job. And then out of this, she developed an illness, and she died quite young.
How old was she when she died?
She was 48.
What was the illness?
She had the arteriosclerosis. And is having to work and working so hard didn't help this a bit.
You feel that more or less she just worked herself to death?
I do, yes. Because, see, my mother died at 48.
How old was she when she got to California?
Oh, let's see, she was born in 1902. She was 33.
So in a 15-year period after she came to California.
And it wasn't long after we came to California that she was sick.
How did it first show up that she was ill?
Oh, I don't recall. I don't recall. But the picture of my mother is that she was never really strong, real well. I can remember my mother always hurting a great deal, but yet going on with all the pain.
You think maybe it was that way for your father, too?
Oh, I'm sure my dad suffered great pain. Not as much physically as my mother, but I'm sure the other pain was just as acute, if not more so.
Do you remember your father talking about those times? Do you remember anything that he... Did he talk about it later on in life?
You know, I was... we were gone from here for many years. And so after I came home from service, I didn't spend a great deal of time with my father, because we lived away. And he never talked a great deal, But before he died just a few years ago, we got to spend some time together. And one thing I noticed in particular about him, when we talked about those days, he remembered the good things, which I thought was real good. He'd remember the good things about his boys and his girls. So I guess time is a good way to take care of some of these pains. But I know my father suffered because having to do what he did and having the time that he had, sitting on a tractor all night long, six nights a week.
Now that was here in California.
In California. A man could think a great deal.
Did he have trouble sleeping during the day?
No, not really. But it was an awful drag on him. I can remember him being tired. And they worked six nights. And then when I look back and think what he went through, I guess most people would drink or do something under those conditions, those circumstances.
How did she make it difficult for you? How was it difficult?
Yeah, well, abusive. Being abusive toward us.
How's that?
Well, calling us trash. We were really trash to her.
She called you trash?
Yes, yes.
And what else?
Well,
why were you trash? Did you misbehave?
At first, I don't think so. Because we had not been reared to misbehave. And we were good students in Texas. Very good students. But somehow we got off on the wrong foot here, and that year we were not good students. And we slipped into behavior that was not good at all. And we reacted toward this type of treatment, and we were in trouble.
Did you dress like the other students?
Well, not as well. But we were always clean, you know, this type of thing, very clean.
I just, she called you trash. Did you act like trash?
No, no.
What was the problem?
Well, then there was a term, you know, we were all Okies. Well, we weren't from Oklahoma, but that's just a term for this group. We were just Okies to her, and Okies were inferior.
Well, how did you? I know you misbehaved, got into some problems. How did you react to that? What were the reactions you had to being treated as trash?
Oh, well, I certainly didn't like it because I didn't feel like trash. But it's kind of interesting when you only know one way of life, and for the first 10 years you grow up in an environment. And that's the only way you know, that's the only thing you have ever experienced, then that's a good way of life because you don't know anything differently. And then one day at the age of 10, you're called trash. And we thought we were doing quite well. Getting to California was really an accomplishment for us. But it wasn't so great to some of the people we encountered, especially this one person. So we reacted against her and against her little girl that would come to school.
How was that?
Well, we would treat her kind of mean.
The girl?
Yes. Because during lunch hour, we'd be out in the salt cedar trees, and she would come out in order to tattle on us, to go tell Mama. And so we would mistreat her sometimes. We really did.
How's that?
Do you want me to share personal things here? It's nothing bad.
Okay.
But like we'd be up.
Please.
Okay. We'd be up in the tree.
I don't mean please don't share something bad, but please share it.
Okay. we'd be up in the trees. And I remember one day in particular, and she came out, this little girl, in order to tattle on us. And one of the boys decided to get even with her, so he peed on her. So we certainly got ahead that day. But then we would catch it. It was, and see, we did, after this classification, we did kind of live that way, you know. The behavior was uncalled for.
Now, how did your mother handle this change in your behavior?
Oh, daily spankings, at least daily. My mother would not tolerate this type of thing. But she didn't like, certainly didn't agree with the teacher either. But regardless, we should not act the way we acted. And so we caught it.
Well, now, what was the effect of this on you, this rejection of your goodness? As a child, I know you felt that you were good and that what you were doing was okay. How did that affect you in the next period of years? Did it have a long-term effect?
No, not really. Mm-hmm. Not really. Because we went there. I say we because my brother and I were in the same grade all through school. He was older, but we went to school together. So we were there just 1 year in the fifth grade. We were supposed to have gone there the next year, the sixth grade, but my mother said no. She would not have it. And so for the next year, we came into Dos Palos, to the sixth grade. Now, my mother went so far as to provide transportation for us. Now, at this time, they had a school bus that came into town. And if there was room on the bus, we could ride it. But if not, my older sister drove us into town each day to school. And she was in high school. But the next year, the sixth grade, was probably the best year of all the years in school.
This was 1936.
We had a young teacher just out of college that appreciated and worked with us. She's still here today. And this is the best year of school. So the fifth grade was bad, but the sixth grade was super good.
Did that have a permanent effect on you?
Yes. Yes, that helped a great deal. But the fifth grade did have an effect, though. I see that now, because then a little later we got into junior high, and we were not good students then.
Well, when you had this young teacher, did she make have a permanent effect on you?
Yes, yes.
How would you describe that?
Well, with self-worth, she treated us as kids want to be treated, with, you know, dignity and respect, and she showed us kindness, real kindness, which we needed.
Did you ever forget that?
No. No. And as a matter of fact, I saw her recently and thanked her again.
I don't, now this is an aside, but I've heard it said that with teachers sometimes that a particular experience or a particular act on the part of a teacher can change a person's life. Now, I know that you have a great deal of education after you became an adult. Was that in any way responsible for it? Was this teacher or that positive experience in any way responsible for that?
I think so, because when you look back after all these years and you have such a warm feeling, and you've had that all of these years toward this teacher and this particular time, I know it had a very lasting effect for good.
What do you think might have happened if you'd had another bad teacher? You think it would have turned you around permanently?
It could have, because we'd already had a real bad year, and things were not going well. So had this continued, we could have been turned around for Bud. I think so.
You obviously have strong feelings about this.
Oh, very strong. Very strong.
Can you describe this teacher you like so well? What did she look like?
I really don't remember, because I know her today.
Oh.
What she looks like today. But I remember she was just out of college, a young teacher, first job, and very kind, extremely kind to us.
How did you act in school in the sense of a different behavior? Did you still cut up? Did you still create problems?
Not for her, no. No, we did not.
Trying to be a good student?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And were you?
Yes. Well, even during the fifth grade, I was a good student.
It must be pretty tough to know you're okay and have somebody tell you you're not.
It's terribly hard. And looking back, as I mentioned earlier, this is repetitious, but I think it's so important that when you don't know differently, and someone tells you you're trash, and you don't know what trash is,
you see. No, it's not me.
Right. No, it couldn't be, because we're okay, but then to be hammered on with that, it does have a negative effect on you. But luckily, the next year offset it for the most part.
All right, we go on then.
Okay.
I did feel that that's important, though.
Mm-hmm.
That's why.
It has been. Has been.
I could see that you were affected by it. That's mm-hmm. why I asked. Well, how about your family adjusting to living in Fireball? How did they adjust to that? What was happening with your parents?
All right. So, and we got here in the fall of 35, and we were living out in at this one ranch, and we picked cotton that fall because my father couldn't get a job. And then the winter months came on, and they were terribly bad. Living in a camp with no running water and no inside plumbing, which we'd never had though, but mud and it was a bad winter, and my father, I can remember this, he was very upset because he could not find work, but there was nothing to do, and it was raining. But he did one thing. He learned how to drive a tractor during this time, and because this is what he wanted to do. He felt that he could do better driving equipment than any other way.
How did he get this instruction?
Well, through the foreman there at the ranch. So he got to know them. And my uncle, having a store there, knew the people very well. And so by making friends, and he learned how to operate the equipment. And we stayed at this one ranch about 6 months through the winter. And then in the spring, we moved just a few miles over, two or 3 months.
How did you eat that winter? If he wasn't working, how did you eat?
Well, my aunt and uncle helped us. I remember that. And but if he picked up, during that time, the cotton, especially during the winter months when it was raining, and the cotton picking would last, because we'd pick cotton after the first of the year.
Did you pick cotton?
We picked on the weekends, yes. Uh-huh. You know? When it wasn't wet, we picked cotton. Oh, yeah, I picked cotton all my life.
So you went to school during the week and picked cotton on the weekend?
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And my father was and mother were able to pick up a few dollars this way, and we just survived. That was about all.
Do you remember what kind of food you ate in that camp?
Yes, again, we ate a lot of biscuits and gravy. This was really our main diet.
How did your mother make the biscuits? Do you remember? Were they water biscuits?
Water biscuits, yes. Water biscuits and water gravy. And then we were introduced to the canned milk. Then my mother learned how to use the canned milk very efficiently.
It's kind of hard when you think back on that, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, so after that 6 months bad winter, what happened?
Well, we moved just a few miles, and my father was able to get a job.
You moved a few miles to where?
To another camp, just a couple of miles away, which to another cotton camp.
Which camp was this?
This was called the Lion and Hogue Ranch.
Lion?
Lion, L-Y-O-N.
And Hogue?
And Hogue, H-O-A-G. And we lived there for 6 years. And my father, this would be the spring of 36, he started driving tractor for them.
That was a good investment in training.
Yeah, it really was. It really saved the day. But again, he worked long, hard hours.
How old was he now at that point?
Well, he was nearing 40. Mm-hmm. And I can remember him working at night. He drove tractor at night from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. all night with a lunch break in there. And he was paid $60 a month.
How much did you get 100 when you picked on the weekends? Do you remember?
Oh, we picked cotton for 50 cents a 100.
Did the money go to the children or to the family?
Family. All the way to the family. And this is how we survived. We always worked. And during the next summer, I was 11. This was 1936, I was 11. We started working the fields. We hired out in the fields. At 11, I chopped cotton with adults. And then we chopped cotton and hoed cotton all summer.
Well, that wasn't too hard, was it?
Chopping cotton? Extremely hard. And extremely hot in the valley here.
And you were 11 years old?
11.
That's pretty good work for a little kid. Were you a little kid?
Very small. But strong. I guess we were strong kids. Because we had worked. Evidently, we had built up some resistance. So we chopped the cotton in the weeds all summer. And then in the fall, we'd pick cotton. And it would go into the winter months. And we were able to, buy clothes. And
when you chopped cotton in the field, did you just do it leisurely like you wanted to?
Oh, no. We always had a foreman and chopping with adults, so we chopped hard all day. And I chopped row for row with adults.
Well, you were 11 years old. I mean, you must have goofed off.
No, you didn't goof off.
What would have happened if you did?
You'd get fired. And then you'd answer to Mother. Mother carried a big stick. No, she was very sweet, but we did work. We had to work, and she knew it.
How many hours would you work a day?
We would go to work at 8, and we'd work to 5 or 6. We'd work 8 to 10 hours a day.
Well, did things then generally improve after your father got the job driving tractor?
Yes. A good bit.
Were you still living in a tent camp?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, at this time we had, we had two rooms for a while. Not long after that, my brother and I, now we're 11, 12, that age, we decided we want our own bedroom. So we were able to get a tent frame, and we managed a tent. So we had our own bedroom for the first time. It was a tent.
And did you have separate beds or the same bed?
No, we always slept together, one bed.
Did your family gradually furnish the tent in an improved way?
No, we just had a bed, that was all.
What about the table and chairs and things?
Oh, yes, yes. You mean in like the kitchen area? Yes. My mother was able to upgrade that.
Did the food improve?
Yes, considerably. But we always ate the very staple things, you know. So my mother was a good cook, but when you are reared on a certain type of food, that's what you eat. Heavy starch.
I have a question that might go all the way back to Texas, might start us over again, but what about health care? Let's take it all the way back to Texas.
All right.
How was health? Were people healthy?
I guess we'd have to say that they were healthy to a large degree for this reason. We never went to a doctor.
Well, why not?
Well, people just didn't go to the doctor. If they got sick, they were sick and they got over it. Or they, what else? You know, whatever. But we just didn't go to a doctor for anything.
Wasn't there a doctor there?
I guess there was one in Kemp.
In Kemp, Texas?
Mm-hmm. But see, we never... I must have been 14 before I went to a doctor.
Well, that's just amazing. Why? I can't imagine why you wouldn't go to a doctor. I have talked to doctors from that period, and they say that one of the problems was that when they did see a person, they were so far gone, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That there wasn't anything they could do. Would that be consistent with what you've seen?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. As a little side thing, my father passed away 3 years ago. He had a stroke in Santa Cruz. And they took him to the hospital there. And he was kind of semi-conscious. Or, you know, he was really unconscious. He couldn't talk much. And they were trying to get information about him. The nurse wanted to know who his dentist was. He didn't have one. My father had never been to a dentist, and he was 78. They asked him who his doctor was, and he didn't have a doctor because he hadn't been to a doctor in 25 years. Now, this was just 3 years ago. So, see, this is the way we grew up, just not going to doctors.
What did people do when they were sick? Did they have home remedies?
Oh, yes, yes.
Do you remember any?
Oh, yes, I can remember. Kids would get impetigo. Well, we called it itch then. And I remember the sulfur remedy and for the croup, which is a cough, would take sugar with a little kerosene on it. And doesn't sound too good, does it? So, and the polis type thing with the mustard plasters and.
Did you ever have one of those?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Was it fun?
No. It smelled terrible.
Did it burn?
And burned.
Mm-hmm. Was it effective?
I guess so. I think we got better in spite.
What about childbirth? Do you ever remember any instances of people having children, bearing children?
No, I don't remember that. But I know we were all born at home with the midwife.
The midwife?
Mm-hmm.
Who would that be?
Relative, usually.
Did the children usually survive?
Well, now, in our family, the oldest one died of a complication. But the other four are still living.
The oldest one died in complication of childbirth?
No, it was about two.
Did you have the flu? Either in California or in Texas?
Oh, I'm sure we'd get colds. But, like I say, we'd take a little home remedy for cough and go on.
What about after you got to California? Did you have... better medical care here?
We still didn't have any. See, I was 14 before I went to a doctor. So we still didn't use the doctor, even after we came here. I remember my mother, we had been here for some time. My mother had to have surgery. And that was quite an experience for her to go to a hospital and have surgery.
Was she comfortable with that?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Do you remember visiting her in the hospital?
Yes.
Do you remember your impressions?
Well, yes, I remember it didn't smell very well. You know, the odors were...
Which hospital was this?
Fresno.
Fresno...
Community.
Was it a private or...
No, it's county hospital. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that she got good care there?
Yes, because we... our local... Now, I remember at that time, the doctors she went to here, you know, helped with that down there. And this helped a great deal.
Do you remember the doctor here?
Yes, I remember him.
It was male?
Male.
What was he like?
Very nice. And I remember he was my doctor when I was 14. I went to him. And I still see him occasionally.
Now, this was your first... contact with a doctor?
First contact, yes.
What was it about?
Yes, it was at 14, the circumcision.
And what did you think about going to a doctor, having not seen one before? Do you remember?
It was really, really quite scary, having to go in and talk to a person, you know, that I didn't know, had never seen. And then something so personal as the genitals. This was really tough.
You got through it, though.
Yeah.
Did you see him more frequently than after that?
Not very often, no.
That part really didn't change.
Well...
You were going to school all this time. We've talked about 35, 36, 37. What about that period, 1937? Anything in particular that stands out?
In 1937, that would mean we started to junior high here. And, this was quite an experience also, because in junior high, then you're away from the self-contained classes. And I can remember going into the other type class, departmental type. And this was a big change to have three or four different teachers.
Which school was this?
Here in Dos Palos. We came into town here.
Yeah. Were you a good student at this time?
No, I didn't. I could have done so well, but I didn't. I didn't work very hard.
Were you still working in the fields on weekends?
Oh, yes. Always.
Maybe that had something to do with it.
I'm sure it did. But it was, looking back, the teachers and so forth, for the most part, at this time, were okay.
They treated you?
Yes, for the most part. And then we were exposed to scouting and... things like that, and we got to do a few more things. There was a skating rink in town, so we did a few more things, and we were getting on up. See, my brother, I was 14, he was 16, and we had a car by then. We had an old clunker, but we could go places.
This was about the time that the United States was getting involved in, or the war was developing in Europe. Do you remember that?
Yeah, very well. I was 16.
Do you remember the speculation or what you thought about it?
No, I don't remember that much about what happened before, but I remember Pearl Harbor extremely well that day.
Where were you?
Well, we were at the Linehoe Ranch. And it was on a Sunday, and we had a radio, a little radio, and it came over, you know, the radio about noon, somewhere around noon, and I remember it so vividly. And of course, and what made it even more vivid, had a cousin on the Arizona that was in Pearl Harbor, and he was killed there. So then it became very, it became personal immediately.
How did you feel? What did you think? You say it was personal. How was it?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, soon after, having learned that our cousin was dead and a personal interest, I should have said.
Did you feel anger? Or?
I don't think so, not at that time. Because I probably didn't know that much about what was going on. Didn't know that much about current history. Because our only exposure was what we got in school.
Your brother was old enough to go into the service then, right?
Yes. He went into service, see, that happened in 41. He went into service either in 42 or 43. Mm-hmm.
This is session one, tape one, of an interview with Reverend Billy Pate for the California State College Bakersfield California Odyssey Project by Michael Neely at 1613 Ida Street, Dos Palos, California, 93620, on March 5, 1981, at 9 a.m. Well, you were 11 years old when you came to California, is that right?
10.
10?
Uh-huh.
Do you remember anything at all from Texas?
Yes, a good bit. But as I said, there are parts of the early days in East Texas that I've really kind of blocked out. But I remember a lot of things.
Well, what's the earliest thing you remember?
Well, school, one thing, and then also our living conditions and our work, the way we lived and the work that we did. See, my father was a sharecropper, mm-hmm. and we had a small farm.
What was the country like from where you lived? What did you see when you looked out?
Well, we lived in the river bottom area, and there were lots of trees. And where we lived in particular, small hills, sand hills, and with trees and clearings for farming.
What kind of trees were there?
A lot of oak trees, mm-hmm. and pecans, this type of tree.
And your house, what was that like?
Well, the last place we lived, we were there about 3 years. And it was a small house with just a kitchen and a living room and one bedroom.
What kind of bed did you have?
Well, we had a regular size bed, but three of us slept in it.
Was it a feather bed?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you make it yourself, your family?
Yes.
How did you do that?
Well, my mother was quite handy on these things, and she and other ladies helped each other, and they made their own bedding, quilts, and with their down and their whatever they had available.
Now, who did you sleep with in this bed?
There was my brother, and then my sister that's older than both of us.
Did you have any problems with three people sharing a bed, and someone pulling the covers, or...
Yeah, that's always a problem. But with each other, I don't remember any problems. We seemingly got along quite well. But we didn't have room, and so we just had to double up to...
Did it bother you that you didn't have your own room?
No, no. Because I didn't know you're supposed to have your own room.
What did the house look like from the outside?
It was an old house, just a board. Boards nailed on the outside, and it was old. And the cracks were bad, and the wind would blow through, and dust and all, but it was just an old shack, really.
What did you have on the floor?
Nothing.
Just wood?
Just wood, uh-huh.
And the kitchen, what did that look like?
Well, had a wood stove.
Cast iron?
Cast iron stove, uh-huh. And just a table and a couple of benches, one on each side.
Did you have indoor plumbing?
No.
Where did you get your water?
We had a cistern that caught the water.
What's that?
Well, a cistern is a holding tank like, and it catches the water from the house. It's piped in through the gutters, from the gutters into the cisterns.
From the roof?
From the roof. Mm-hmm.
And you had enough water that way?
No, not really. Well, in the summertime, if it didn't rain, we had to be very careful. So there's usually a shortage of water.
Was the cistern underground?
Underground.
Uh-huh. And you would dip with a bucket or?
A bucket and a rope.
And then you carried it in, and did you set it in a bucket in the kitchen or?
Yes, yes. There was always a water bucket and the dipper that went with it for the drinking.
Was it a wooden bucket or a?
No, it was metal.
Metal bucket. And do you remember what your father looked like?
Yes, quite well. He was a tall, slender person. I was thinking back the other day that when we came to California, he was a young man, but I guess youngsters always think of their parents as being old.
How old was he?
See, he was, he would have been about 38.
He was 28 when you were born.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's a young man.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember how he dressed in Texas? What kind of clothes he usually wore?
Yes. Then the Sunday clothes were khaki, and they wore the blue denims, the denim type clothes, ducking, they called it, for work. Mm-hmm. But the dress clothes was the khaki.
Did he wear overalls?
Yes. Yes.
And what kind of shoes did he wear?
The lace up work shoes, the heavy type work shoes.
Did he wear a hat?
Yes. Straw.
Straw. And what did your mother wear?
My mother always wore now we're talking about the summertime when we were working. She always wore a jumper type garment. And she was always, I thought, overdressed. I can remember it very plainly. She always wore a lot of clothing. She said, well, it's cooler when you wear more clothing. And I can remember my mother making and wearing bonnets. She liked the bonnet.
Was she a good cook?
Excellent. Excellent.
What would a typical breakfast be like? Well, before breakfast, let's start. What time would you all get up?
Well, we had probably around 6:30, 7 o'clock, because we walked to school, and so we got up a little earlier.
What time did your parents get up? Same time?
No. My father was always up before daybreak.
And your mother?
Shortly thereafter. Uh-huh.
And what would be do you remember the morning routine for the family? It's what your mother and father would do, and the kids get up?
Yes, well, I can remember my father, he would get up very early, and because he always had the animals to feed and wood to chop and these things, the chore. He had to do chores in the morning and night. So father was always up early, and then my mother would be up cooking and getting ready for the day, for the field or for school.
Did your mother work in the field?
Yes, always.
What did you have for breakfast? I know it varied, but in general.
Well, we'd have we always had chickens, so we had eggs. And we always had a milk cow, so we'd have milk. So we ate the things that we grew or supplied there on the little farm.
And then the children would go to school?
Yes.
How far was it?
About 3 miles.
And you walked?
Yes.
And where was your parents' work?
Well, they're at the farm.
They worked on
you? On the farm, uh-huh. Because my father was the sharecropper, so he had the land leased by the year.
What kind of work did he do there? Just handiwork, or?
Well,
what were his duties?
Well, in the spring, he'd get the land ready, the plowing and harrowing and so forth, getting the land ready for, we raised cotton primarily. And so this was he farmed strictly with mules. So it was rather slow going. He didn't farm too many acres, but it took him a long time to get ready. And so his days were spent on the land, and in the wintertime there wasn't much to do except take care of the livestock.
Was he paid?
No. See, he sold his cotton. Maybe he made 3 or 4 bales of cotton a year. That was very good. And
how much was a bale worth, do you remember?
No, I don't. Okay. Not much.
And then how did you dress to go to school? Do you remember?
Yeah, we just wore the ducking pants, you know, and a lot of times they were homemade. Most of the time they were made by mother or someone. See, they made most of our clothes. We didn't buy clothes. We didn't buy very many things.
Well, something's wrong here. Where did you get the things that you had? Did you make them?
Made them, and the food stuff. We grew everything we ate except sugar and coffee, I guess, and a little. Primarily sugar and coffee is the rest of things. You know, we grew there, and really our diet wasn't that broad. I can remember we ate a lot of gravy.
What would be a special treat?
A special treat. All right. In the summertime, we would pick a bale of cotton and to be able to go to town with Father. He had to haul about the cotton about 3 or 4 miles to the gin. And then if we'd have a little money, a special treat would be to have store-bought bread. We called it light bread. To have light bread and bologna that night. Or cheese and crackers. Those were special treats.
Do you remember what your school looked like?
Not too well. Not that well at all.
Was it a one-room school?
No. In Texas, there was about four teachers in the school where we went. So it was a one-grade school. Each grade had a separate teacher.
I don't think I asked you what town that was.
It's a little rural area about 50 miles from Dallas called Kemp, Texas.
Well, how long did you stay there? About 3 years, you said?
At the last place we lived, mm-hmm. About 3 years.
And then you came to California?
Yes, from this place we came to California.
And what year was that you came to California?
1935. In the fall.
Do you remember, say, the year or two just prior to coming to California, do you remember the kinds of things that happened that made your family decide to leave?
Yes.
Okay.
As I mentioned, Dad was, we were was a very poor sharecropper, and times were really hard for him, and to make a living, because there were four children. And I remember when we decided that we were coming to California, how that the summer of 1935, Dad worked not only his little farm, but he worked out in order to save a little bit of money. And he did what they call row binding, binding corn in shocks, running a row binder at night by a lantern. It was pulled by horses, and he worked all night, and his pay was the $1.25 a night.
And then he worked the next day.
Then he worked the next day to get ready. And then another thing that helped, my father's estate was settled, and my father got $36 from it. And this was money that we used to come to California on.
Were times hard for everyone?
Everyone.
Mm-hmm. Did you? Was this in the Dust Bowl period? Was there a dust problem?
Not where we were. But see, this was the heart of the Depression. Mm-hmm. And
what effect did that have on you? I know times were hard, but what were the changes, do you remember, that came with the Depression? How did things change?
No. See, I don't remember anything before the Depression, so I just remember this part, and I thought everyone, when you live in a small area where we lived, which was 50 miles from Dallas, but I had never been to Dallas.
Had you ever ridden in a car?
Yes. Yes, my father had an old car. He had I remember he had a Model T Ford.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the first time you rode in it?
No, I don't. Right. But I remember we traveled by wagon a lot before that, and I can remember traveling by wagon going down to see relatives a few miles away and riding in the wagon.
Had you ever ridden in a train?
No. No. Yeah. I had never seen one.
Can you describe the immediate preparations of your family before coming, before leaving? What did they do?
Yes, it was a happy time because my mother had two half sisters that were living here in Fireball, and we were coming here to where they were, and we worked all summer getting ready and. The few things we had had to be disposed of, which wasn't much, and then working and trying to get a few dollars together. And I remember when we left Texas, we loaded up a few things, and we had we came to California in a Model A Ford, the six of us, with a couple of mattresses on top of the car, and we took off.
Exactly what time was that?
Yes, it was late August, early September, in the fall
of
1935.
And do you remember the trip out?
Yes. Uh-huh. It was very hot that year. I remember that. It was terribly hot. And we stopped up in West Texas. This was quite a trip for me because, as I said, I had never been to Dallas. And to see the tall buildings and the cars and the people were unreal. And we drove up to West Texas and spent some time a night with my father's sister.
Where was that?
In Wichita Falls, Texas. And we hadn't seen her in years and years because, well, back then they lived any distance at all. They didn't visit very much.
Was her house modern?
No, no. Uh-uh.
It was outside of town or in town?
Outside.
Mm-hmm. Were you impressed with it anyway?
No, I was more impressed when we got to New Mexico.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Then we came on to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we spent about a week there. My mother had a half-brother that lived in Albuquerque, and he was rather affluent. He worked for the power companies and had for years, so he had a good job, and they had a nice home, a little Spanish stucco home, and we spent a week there, and this is when I was exposed to the bicycle. The kids had a bike. And we spent the week there learning how to ride the bike.
And you'd never seen one before?
No.
Mm-mm. What kind of bicycle was that? Do you remember? How would it differ from today's bicycle?
Well, it was the old clunker type. It wasn't the 5-speed or 3-speed. It was just a regular old bike that was rather difficult to operate, to paddle and so forth, pedal. But we learned to ride it.
And you like that?
I like that very much.
Was there anything else on the trip that surprised you? Or, like, a lot of things must have surprised
yes,
you.
Yes. I remember coming through the mountains over Needles area, the Oatman Hills. I remember that very well. It was the old road, and it was very steep and with very sharp curves, and I remember the fear of coming across there, and my poor mother was, terribly frightened coming across there, and always telling Howard to slow down.
That was your father's name?
Yes.
I forgot to ask, did you just go, when you were traveling from Wichita Falls to Albuquerque, did you stop on the way? Did you spend the night someplace in there?
No, we made that trip in one day, long day. But then when we left Albuquerque, we had to stop over.
Where did you stop?
Well, we spent, I remember one night down by Needles, and we slept along the road.
Wasn't that dangerous?
Yeah, I guess it was, and quite scary to me because we spent the night. We stopped after dark, and it was a gravel pit, and we'd heard about the rattlesnakes in California, so I was very frightened all that night. I just knew snakes were everywhere.
Did you sleep on the ground?
No, we slept on the mattress. We'd take the mattress off from the car and sleep on it.
Did you cook food?
We ate mostly sandwiches, you know, stuff like that could be purchased.
How much money did you have when you left Texas? Do you remember? The $36?
I had the $36 and not a whole lot more.
Do you remember how much you had when you got to California?
None. No, we were just, my father just didn't have any resources left when we got here.
Do you remember how he reacted to that? Now, the farmer, you were talking about him being a hard worker. He had to be a proud man. Only a proud man would work like that. How did this affect him all of a sudden having nothing? Do you remember how it affected him?
My father never shared feelings. He was a very quiet man. And I really don't know how he felt. I wish I did. But he was a very quiet man. And he just didn't talk about things like that. He didn't talk about personal things. He never shared a feeling with me that I can remember.
Did he laugh?
Not a great deal. I think the hard life really took a toll on some of these fellows. Because it was hard. And the big responsibility he had of feeding 6 people.
How about your mother? Did she talk about it?
Yes, yes. My mother talked about it a great deal. A great deal more than he did, which was nothing. But it affected my mother differently. My mother was, for that day, she was rather intelligent. Having gone through the 8th grade, which was quite good from that area. So she felt things perhaps more keenly or expressed them more openly.
Let me ask you another question. I don't mean to stop you.
All right.
How much education would a school teacher have?
My mother could have taught school.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So she was actually very well educated.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, then you got to California, and you went to these relatives in Fireball.
Yes, we came, we drove from Needles to Fireball the next day, and this was a rather long trip in a Model A Ford. And we got into Fireball after dark again.
You came from Needles to Fireball in one day?
Mm-hmm. You stay with it. And it was after dark, and we didn't know where we were, so we spent the next night just outside of Fireball by the canal. And again, you know, we took our mattress down and slept on the ground.
Now, I forgot to ask you a question. I should have. When you came into California, were you stopped at a station?
Yes.
And what was that like? Do you remember?
Well, we had heard about it, and they were looking for fruits and plants and so forth. And of course, we didn't have anything like that. But we did stop for the inspection.
Were they polite?
Yes, I don't. Yes, I'm sure they were.
They were decent to you.
Mm-hmm.
Did they ask a lot of questions?
No, because we didn't have much to inspect. You know, it didn't take long.
You didn't encounter any hostility on the trip?
I don't remember any. No, I can remember it was really quite pleasant under the adverse circumstances. You know, but it was really, I guess Albuquerque helped a great deal.
Now, you were camped outside of Fireball. How did you get in?
So then the next morning we asked, or my father asked where the Hammond Ranch was. That's where we were headed.
Hammond?
For Hammond Ranch. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we went out the next morning, and my uncle had a little store at the cotton camp. At that time it was a large cotton camp, huge.
At the Hammond Ranch?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We got there, and
when was this?
This was in September of 1935. We got here, and we were able to get two cotton cabins, one to cook in and the other to sleep in.
What did they look like?
Just very small wood cabins, probably 14 by 16, just a small square cabin with no water, no plumbing of any kind.
Did they have beds in them?
No. We had to furnish our own everything.
And so how did you do that? How did you establish housekeeping there?
Well, we stayed in this first cotton camp about 6 months. We just had the beds, that's all, and a stove and table.
What kind of stove did you have?
At this time, then, when we came to California, we had the bottle. I remember we had the bottle gas, the flame-o, they called it. So
flame-o?
Flame-o. It's like butane or is today. And so that, we picked cotton that fall. But we started school also. There was a school at the cotton camp, but my mother didn't want us to go to that school. So
why is that?
Well, it was, she wasn't accustomed to migrant people. And she thought, well, it just wouldn't be best. We probably couldn't get the best education there. So we went to a little school called Oraloma.
It was a public school?
It's a public school. Now, this was a one-room school out about 15 miles from here.
How did you get there?
Our teacher's husband picked us up in his car, which was the bus. It was a little sedan car.
Can you contrast the migrant school from the public school?
Yes.
What would be the differences?
Well, at the school at the camp, well, really the other school was migrant also, because we were all migrants. But the school at the camp, I remember, had many Mexican Americans, and we were not accustomed to these people. We had never been around them, and so my mother wasn't comfortable with it at that time.
And in the public school, it was.
There were fewer, and at the public school, many of us were from the South.
What about the teachers? Were they different?
Well, I didn't know the teachers at the camp school, but the teacher at the public school was well, that wasn't a good situation. Probably this was one of the hardest years of my life, the first year we came.
How was that?
Well, for some reason, our teacher resented and made it known that she didn't like the Okies and the Arkies and the Texans. So it was a very bad relationship. See, my brother and I were in the same grade. And then there were two other boys, one from Oklahoma and one from Texas. So there were three of us from Texas and one from Oklahoma in this group. And the teacher made it very difficult for us.
You were saying that when you came to Oklahoma, or I'm sorry, you came to California from Oklahoma, you had from Texas.
Uh-huh.
And you'd had a very limited, circumscribed type of life back there. And then what was your feeling when you came to California?
Well, it was, in one way, it was very traumatic because we had grown up or had lived in Texas in a very protected rural society, then, and never having had any dealings with ethnic groups or minority groups. And then we came to California, and immediately we were thrust into a labor camp with lots of Mexican children. And
do you remember the first Mexican person that you saw?
I think so. Yeah, a couple of young boys, and I remember it was very intimidating, because to me they seemed so aggressive and hostile type, and I built up a fear for them, a dislike, I guess really, well, dislike that grew out of fear. That's what it was, because we were afraid of them, because seemingly they were aggressive kids, and we hadn't been used to that.
Did your parents prepare you in any way for that?
No, none whatsoever, because they didn't know much more than we did when we came out here, because this was another world.
How did you actually, what was your first actual contact with Mike, with the Mexican person? Do you remember?
I remember one evening, as I about dark, the toilets were way out in the back of the camp, and I was coming from the toilet, and a couple of Mexican boys took after me and scared the life out of me. So I took off for the cabin, and the father of one of these boys saw what was happening, and he really worked the kids over severely. And this is one of my very first contacts, and it's interesting. We were different. We were very different.
You mean the people who came from Texas?
Yes, yes, because, we had never seen this. I didn't know what a Mexican child was, he said. And from one environment to a totally different environment, just in 3 days.
Did they seem afraid of you as well?
No, because they got their bluff in first. And then they became intimidating. They would intimidate us. And they would control us through intimidation.
How old were you at this time?
10.
And how old were you? say they were?
Not the same.
Well, how did it turn out?
Well, in the long run, it turned out very well. And then because we became friends and...
How did you make that break? How did you break that hostility down?
Well, I think simply by after school, you know, we went to different schools from the same camp. Remember earlier, we were picked up and hauled to another school.
You and your brother?
And sister.
And sister.
Yeah, all of us.
Went to the public school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Rather than a camp school.
Rather than a camp school. Uh-huh. But then we gradually got to know each other through after school, maybe playing ball or whatever, and gradually built up a very small relationship, I guess. Never anything real tight, because we lived there about 6 months, and then that was kind of the end of that phase. Then when we moved to the next camp, we didn't have just certain times of the year we had these groups coming in, but for the most part we lived with people from Texas and Oklahoma and Arkansas.
Did you have a tendency to stay in the same place, your family?
Yes, uh-huh.
And these minority groups were actually moving with the harvest?
Yeah, these were the days of the migrants.
So you, in fact, were not so much a migrant as someone who was transplanted.
Yes, true, because we did not travel at all. We only moved about 2 or 3 miles the first 6 years we were here.
Do you consider yourself a migrant?
Well, we migrated. See, we migrated, so certainly we were. We did migrate from Texas to California, and we were in the same environment as the migrants. So, I guess we grew up as migrant children.
Once you got out here, can you or do you see a difference between people who migrated with the crops and people who stayed in one area? Is there, in fact, a difference? Or?
Yes, I think so. I think there's a very definite difference, especially with the children in schooling and environment, because they were locked into such a close environment from, you know, camp to camp to camp, and that's really all they experienced for the most part, and usually they were behind in school, because we had a lot of those.
And you're not just talking about Mexican migrants?
Oh no. Because there were probably more white migrants. We were associated with a lot more white migrants than Mexicans.
Did you see any particular problems that these migrant children from the Midwest, did you see any particular problems that they had as a result of moving around with the crops, other than being behind in school?
Yes. I think there was, even then, and looking back, there was a real identity crisis going on in their life. They couldn't identify with anything, because about the time they'd come in for the harvest in the fall, and then they were gone, be back next year. And so they didn't belong anywhere.
Did that create problems in school for them?
Yes. Going from school to school, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 schools a year, and... they were always behind, or for the most part they were behind, not always. So it was a very definite trend.
It would seem to me that they would be placed in an outcast or an out-group sort of situation when they came to a school, a public school especially.
Well, they were segregated because they were called migrants, so that was a particular group.
Did it become that way even for you, that you were in the local group and they were in a migrant group?
Eventually, I think this happened, because after a while, But for a long time, we were certainly with that group. Well, in one way, I don't think we ever got away from it. We were pretty well accepted into the other groups, but yet we were the Dust Bowl kids, and we associated with this group. So that's where we lived. Our friends and so forth were from this background primarily.
This community tends to have that background too, doesn't it?
Yes.
In those polyps, mm-hmm. Fireball.
Very much so. Very much so.
Do you think you feel comfortable here for that reason?
No, I've never really thought of it in that respect. I think I feel comfortable here because these are almost lifelong friends that we grew up with and so forth.
I see this in other interviews, this stability, that while people move from Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas to California, but they stuck. They stuck where they came from, and for some reason they moved, and when they got here they stuck again.
Mm-hmm.
And their life took place in that particular area. The actual migrant phenomenon seems fairly limited, in my experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of that is not where we came from was not a migrating society. We came off of the farms, and the farm people stayed. We lived in one area, and my mother grew up in that area, and my father had moved a little ways into the area. So they just stayed on the farm. They couldn't move. They didn't have money to move. It was very difficult. They couldn't, where would they go? It was the same thing wherever they went down there. There's more cotton. More cotton to pick.
Do you remember working in the crops out here?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Could you describe that to some extent?
Well, we always worked.
What kind of crops did you work?
Cotton.
Always cotton?
Always cotton.
Nothing else?
Well, it got a little older. We worked in the grain, harvested the grain. But for the younger years, up until we got old enough to work on equipment, we worked in cotton. Cotton, cotton.
How did you feel about cotton?
I didn't like cotton.
Why not?
Well, kind of interesting. I was talking to my wife about this just recently. When I was growing up, If a kid didn't like to do something, for instance, if you didn't like to pick cotton, and I certainly didn't like to pick cotton, and then you were lazy. See? And I was called lazy because I didn't like to work in the cotton. Today, I guess they'd say, well, you aren't motivated. But boy, it was true back then. I was never motivated to the cotton field. And so I didn't like it. I resisted it. And so consequently, when it came to that part of it, I was just a lazy kid. But I got a little older, worked around equipment. I was a super equipment operator.
You like that?
I like that. Mm-hmm.
When did you start working with equipment?
About 14.
How did you get into it?
Well, I would go out the days that we didn't work in the field. I would go out and ride the harvesters or the tractors and just learned it. The men, they taught me how to do things, and go on the harvester, ride the harvesters all day, and I learned to sew sacks and tend the header and so forth. I couldn't lift the sacks, but I could sew them.
Tend the header?
Yes.
What's that?
Oh, the header is what cuts the grain. and brings the grain into the shakers, the hitters, where the grain falls on. And then you had to do it all by hand. We had to sit there, stand there all day and raise and lower the header over the levees and so forth to get the grain.
And then it would bring the grain in and shake it?
Mm-hmm.
Very naive when it comes to
So that's, but by the time I was 14, I did a lot of equipment operating. And we learned to drive the tractors, and then later they let us drive the trucks. Got a little older, we'd haul, got a little stronger, then we'd haul sacks, which was terribly hard work.
What do you mean hauling sacks?
Well, then grain was all put in sacks, maybe 100 to 110 pound sacks. And we would buck those sacks onto trucks out of the field.
The machine would leave the sacks in the field?
Uh-huh.
And then the truck would come along and
pick them up.
And bucking is throwing them up on the...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which was very hard work.
Did you get paid well for that?
For that day and time, it would be good pay. But
do you remember how much it was?
Oh, we could make $5 or $6 a day. Which was, you know, a lot of money then.
About what year are we talking about?
We're talking about the late 30s, 38, 39, along in there, 40. So, but then, see, everything was hard work. Everything was manual work. And then later we'd learn, we'd haul hay and... But everything was hard work because it wasn't mechanized. But getting back to that cotton field, that, as I said a while ago, that's one thing I knew for certain that I never wanted to do was work cotton.
Did you express that feeling to your parents?
Always.
And what did they think about it?
Well, they thought, well, you know, not much. They didn't like it. And it caused that was always a little cause of friction. Because, well, you know, their idea was, well, we've got to do it, so we might as well go ahead and do it and not complain. But I complained.
That made you a malcontent, huh?
It did. It certainly did.
Did they feel better once you got into the machinery part of it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Were you learning, I assume you were in high school at this point?
Yes, going into high school. Uh-huh.
And did your studies in school in any way help you with what you were doing in the fields?
No.
Did you continue to work in the fields while you were in high school?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Would it be on weekends or after school? Or?
We'd work after school, weekends, and then during every vacation. We always worked during vacations.
Doesn't sound very lazy.
Well, but if you griped about it, that was lazy, see.
Well, how did high school turn out?
For the most part, I would say high school was a good experience. For the most part. Because some of the teachers, you know, were... Some were very kind, and some were not. And the very kind ones, you remember them most.
How were they kind?
Well, an example, when we were in junior high, we had a young teacher here, and he was right out of college, and he enjoyed the boys. And he started a scout troop, and see, we were able to come to scouts, and another teacher started a rifle association, and these were great things for us, because it was about the only thing that we were involved in except the farming. So I look back and think of, you know, you're grateful for men that did things like this for us. You know, a bunch of little urchins off the farms, and here he's, you know, a scout troop and a rifle association. So those were good. And then there was the other side too, you know. Some of the teachers didn't like us. And
how did that show up?
Well, I remember one in particular. calling names.
Calling names.
Yeah, they call us names. And
the teachers call us names?
Yeah, yeah. I remember one in particular. My brother and I were always in the, as I said, we were always in the same grade. We took the same classes. We were together day and night. And this one teacher liked my brother pretty well, but he didn't care for me. I was kind of a nonconformist. If I didn't like something, I'd say it. And this didn't go over too well. It wasn't very smart on my part either. And this one teacher would call me Addle Pate, meaning, you know, a little bit, not quite all there. And I remembered it.
A little put down.
A little put down, yeah.
Did you do, grade-wise, did you do well?
I could have done real well, but I settled for average. What, mediocrity, really.
Well, what happened when you got out of high school?
Well, the war came along while I was in high school. See, I was 16 when the war came along. And this was the beginning, I guess, of my junior year in high school. Well, it was during, let's see, 41. Yes, it was the beginning of my junior year.
How did it change your life, just the fact that the war was coming? What was the feeling that you had?
I don't remember much about that. It was mostly, I'd have to say we weren't that well informed, really. Didn't know that much about it.
Well, you got into it. How did that come about?
Well, it really changed our lives, you know, quickly because of the call-up of servicemen, and the whole country was affected. And even where we were out down in the lower echelon, we were affected because men were going into service. And it wasn't long before we had a shortage. And we finished our junior year, and in farm labor by that time was already becoming very acute. So my senior year of high school, we didn't go very much, the boys. We worked.
Did you get paid better?
Yeah, yeah. I remember my senior year in the fall, beginning of the senior year, I worked in a cotton gin down in Fireball. I was the yard flunky. I hauled the bales from the gin out to the yard and stacked those. That was my job. So I worked there the whole fall, and then went to school some after that, and then right after my senior year, I went into service.
Did you actually graduate from high school?
Yes, yeah.
In spite of not having gone?
Yeah, yeah. The principal was very kind, very understanding.
They made some exceptions in those days.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Well, you know, had to because of the work had to be done. So the boys, we really filled in a big spot.
Well, how did this decision to go into the service come about?
Well, it was the thing to do. It was the manly thing to do, you know. Boys at 17 and 18... And the propaganda, I guess, looking back, was rather heavy. So you went into service. If you didn't, there was something wrong with you, boy. They looked askance at anyone that wasn't in service.
Did your brother go into service?
Yes.
Which service?
He was in the Army.
Why did you pick a different one? You went into the Marine Corps.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was a little more manly, you know.
Macho.
The propaganda got to me on that one.
I'm surprised you didn't go with your brother.
Well, see, he was a little older, and he went in first. I didn't go until later.
Did you and your brother talk about it?
Oh, yeah, we would have gone in together, but I wasn't old enough. We would have gone together.
He couldn't wait for you?
No. See, he was the older brother, so he had to kind of pave the way. And this was the thing, this was the propaganda that went on, you know. And it was very intense, 18-year-old boys, they were supposed to be in service. Or the talk was, well, why isn't so-and-so in, or, oh, he's 4F, or, and that's a bad word.
Shirker.
Yeah, right, shirker.
But I know you were gone, but how did the work get done when you left? The younger boys?
Younger, yes. Uh-huh. And women? The women took up a lot of the slack here.
Well, when you got into the service, now you'd had some of this discrimination you were mentioning in high school. When you got into the service, was it similar? Or did that suddenly disappear as a part of your life?
It wasn't as noticeable in service because, well, in the Marine Corps, for a long time, everybody's a dog, you know. He's just a dog. That's all there is to it.
Did you know what the Marine Corps was going to be like before you went in?
Had no idea.
Was it a challenging experience?
Yeah. Well, yeah, in a way, but it was a hard experience, too. It was worse than picking cotton at times.
Just for fun.
Okay.
Could you briefly describe your induction? I mean, your orientation to the Marine Corps? Getting in?
Yeah, see, Fresno was a place that we were inducted in Fresno. Then we left there and went to San Diego for boot camp. And that was an eye-opener.
Now, they didn't do anything to you, actually, before you got to San Diego, did they?
No, nothing.
Just rode a bus down there.
Just rode a bus. We were just inducted, caught the bus, and went to San Diego. No preparation whatsoever. We didn't talk to anyone. So, group of us got to San Diego, wee hours of the morning. And, you know, it's very vivid. We thought, well, we'll get a little rest today. But there was no rest. Man, we hit the gate and we were busy. Ran us all day long from place to place, and it was quite an experience for a boy right off the farm that never been to a county fair, you know. So
were they as abusive as the stereotype?
Oh yes, worse.
You had not been accustomed to that.
No, and that was pretty hard to take, you know, because growing up on the farms, in a lot of ways, you know, you have a lot of freedom and you can be very independent. But then to come into a situation as a 17, 18-year-old boy to where you're totally controlled, totally. Day and night, you're controlled. And this was hard. But when you look back on it, I guess it's a necessary thing to break some of those things in young men. You have to do it. Terrible, though, to do it.
Did you have any particular problems in boot camp?
No, not really.
You talked about in high school being somewhat, not defiant, but outspoken. Were you outspoken in boot camp?
No, I wasn't. But I was defiant, yeah. There were some things that I kind of rebelled against. To my chagrin, I shouldn't have. Oh, I remember one day, the line, we had to get up early to get in and shave. The lines were long, and one morning the line was long, and I didn't want to wait. I didn't have enough whiskers for anything, but I wasn't going to shave that day. I thought, well, I can pass inspection. Well, I didn't pass inspection. So that evening, the DI said, be at my hut at 6 o'clock with a dull razor blade. So that evening, I saw he was real busy, so I thought, well, I wasn't going to be outdone, so I ran to the wash house and soaked my face in hot water 2 or 3 minutes. Then I put a new blade in the razor. I didn't take a dull blade. I wasn't that stupid. So I jogged down to his tent, and he was so busy. So I stood there and shaved. It wasn't bad, really, because not very many whiskers and the hot water and the new blade. And he was busy and didn't check it. So I got by that one all right. But I caught myself being defiant. I could never really, you know, I wasn't going to be submissive and everything. And another day we were out drilling, and it was hot. And we wore those old pith helmets. You know what
the round one? Made of canvas?
Yeah, the old canvas. We called them pith. Sounds bad, doesn't it? Anyway, we were out drilling on that hot asphalt. And, oh, I had a headache. So I thought, well, if I can get that band off my eyes, I'll feel better. So I, you know, you had to have it one finger above the eyebrow. That was regulation. So I pushed it back a little bit, and this little old D.I., he was a very small person, but he had a big macho complex, and he liked to work us over. So he came up the line, we were drilling, marching, and he saw that my helmet was too far back. He took his and drilled mine down over my ears.
You mean he hit you with his?
On top of mine, yeah, I just drilled it over my ears. Well, I didn't like him too well after that. I didn't give him any trouble because I couldn't, but I sure was. I was very resistive inside. But this is what they want, you know, get you angry and brainwash, and then you make good assault troops.
They did? Or they didn't?
They did. Oh, yeah, you're angry and you're brainwashed and you don't care. You get to a place you don't care about anything.
It's hard for me to look at you today and put you in that mold, see you as an angry, aggressive assault troop.
Yeah. Well, I look back, I don't like it either. You know, this was a hard thing. It was a hard thing for me to overcome. It really was. All of that drilling, we'll talk about it later, but it had a very adverse effect on me, because I wasn't that way by nature, see.
When you asked for this.
That's right. I asked for it. I got it. But see, when you're 16 and 17, you don't always make the best decisions. And this wasn't a good decision. I should have gone in the Coast Guards, I guess.
Well, anyway, you made it through.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Well, we drilled for a long time. For several weeks.
Still at San Diego?
No, we leave San Diego now, and boot camp is over. And we go to Camp Pendleton, which is just a few miles from San Diego. And we go into combat training. And this was about a six-week course, and it was hard.
Was it real to you? I mean, were you actually anticipating going into combat?
Oh, yes.
So it wasn't a game?
No, it wasn't a game. No. We drilled every day.
Do you think that made a difference in your attitude, knowing that you were actually going into combat?
Yeah, it made a difference. It really helped prepare us. And then you get into the attitude, well, it's coming, and you know, you get that in your mind, you get it programmed in that you're going to combat. You get this thing programmed in. And day after day after day, this is drilled. We drill all day for combat. Combat drills all day and night.
What was a combat drill like?
Oh, we'd get up before daylight. We were out in the field long before daylight, with all of our gear. And at this time, see, I was in communications. And we carried on our backs our radios and wire and the heavy equipment. We carried it. We'd break out early in the morning and take off over the hill. Never walking, always in a trot. And here you may be on the other end of a 90-pound drum of wire, or a 40-pound radio on your back, and we'd go for a while and set up, you know, our command post set up. Yeti communication, breakdown, load up, jog, set up, breakdown, day and night. See? And this is what it was like in getting ready for combat. And we did this for weeks. Then we're almost ready to ship out. This is where I get into a little trouble. And at that, we were really packing equipment ready to ship. And we had leaves. We know we could get leaves on the weekend. And we had a 48 and a 72-hour passes. Well, on a 48-hour pass, we could come to Los Angeles for the weekend. Well, on a 72-hour pass, I could hitchhike home. My folks lived in Fireball. And my brother was home, and he was getting married this weekend. And I wanted to come home.
Do you remember what year that was?
It's in 1943. It was 44.
What month in 44?
In June. June of 44. And I wasn't scheduled for a 72-hour pass, so I thought, well, all right, I can switch, you know, with no problem. So I went to my CO, and I told him I wanted to go home. And I told him the reason, and I'd switch and make up anything. But he was resistive. He says, no, you can't. I mean, very firmly, a very firm no. So, okay. So, well, I'll go home anyway on the 48-hour pass. So I came home, and when the wedding was over, I wasn't quite ready to go back, so I took 6 extra days. See, this was rebellion. He said I couldn't go, and I was going anyway. And when I got there, I thought, well, extend this leave. So I was 6 days late getting back to camp.
I'm sure they understood.
Yeah. They understood all right. I did, too, later. But it went pretty good, though, really. I could have gotten brig time and all of that. But my buddies in at headquarters, they covered up a lot of it, okay. And the lieutenant had really made a mistake, too, and he knew it, and they reminded him of it. So, but he had to do something. So I got 30 days EPD.
What's that?
Extra
punishment? Punitive?
Police duty. Extra police duty. That means you get all the crap. Anything that's dirty, you get it. So, I was shoved in a warehouse packing gear, which is hot and heavy work, but it didn't matter. I had a vacation, so I could whistle on through the warehouse. So, and in 2 weeks we shipped out. We were aboard ship.
What was that like for you? Was it it certainly wasn't luxurious.
No, we went aboard the oldest ship in the Navy, the American Legion, and I don't know, that thing must have. I think it was from Columbus days, but it was a terrible old ship. But my EPD wasn't up yet. So they shoved me in the mess hall. So my trip from San Diego to Hawaii, went to Hawaii, my trip was below deck, washing pots and pans.
Is that good or bad?
It was terrible. It was hot and dirty and all those good things, but I could still whistle through this because I knew it wasn't going to last long. So we got to Hawaii, and some of them were getting leave, and I was still on restriction. But it wasn't bad, you know. You can take anything for a month, and so. But my first cruise to Hawaii was below deck washing pots and pans. We got to Hawaii and set up there, and that was our home base.
Where did you set up in Hawaii?
Up from Hilo. We were on the big island. We had a division up above Hilo.
What were you doing there, preparing for an invasion of some kind?
Yeah, it was all combat training. All combat. We spent a lot of time on the beaches and rubber boats and the Higgins equipment. You know, for a year, we prepared for landings.
In Hawaii, you stayed for a year.
No, in here in California, and then in Hawaii, we continued. See, we were assault troops. And we had the spearhead. We were always the spearhead, is what we were called. As a matter of fact, our division was called the Spearhead Division. See?
You must have got your division must have been very good at it with all that training.
It was. We were good, really good. And we got to Hawaii in August. Then we shipped out of Hawaii just before Christmas. We went aboard ship, I think, Christmas Eve to go out. And we spent almost three months aboard ship. It's a long haul, boy, with 5,000 troops on one ship for 3 months.
Had plenty of room and lots of recreation.
Well, I went aboard ship last because we stayed behind to do some last-minute things. So we caught the ship in Honolulu, and the bunks were all gone. So a group of us slept on deck. We slept on deck, on the deck, for the 3 months. But that was nicer than the holds anyway, if it was steel. And we'd pull maneuvers all out in the Pacific. We'd go to an island, pull more maneuvers, more landings. Now, at this time now, we're going over the ship, over the sides of the ship. This is the real thing. We're pulling maneuvers, getting ready to go in.
Did you lose people in these maneuvers?
Yeah. Frequently, especially if it was get rough. You know, the ocean would get rough, and it wasn't unusual to crush a person against the side of a ship.
Did you ever witness one of those?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, we were loading. We were going back aboard ship, and see. We're climbing nets. These are all nets that we're climbing. And at the same time, we're loaded with equipment. We have our equipment on our backs or whatever, and we're climbing these nets. And this fella got caught between some equipment and the ship, and it crushed him.
Did you know him?
No, I didn't know him.
In some ways, that was preparation for what was going to come, though.
Yeah. I guess you get you get hardened to these things. You don't really take them to heart. So then we went on. Then in February of 45, we landed on Iwo Jima.
Were you, in fact, the spearhead?
Third wave. So we landed 8 hour plus 19 minutes.
What was your mental state the day before? Did you know you were going in?
Oh, yeah.
What were you thinking? Do you remember?
Yes, I remember.
Were you afraid? Were you anxious? Were you eager?
No, I don't really think any of those. I wasn't afraid. And I don't remember being very anxious. It was kind of like it was hard to realize that the next day what we're going to be doing. Although we had seen films and all of these things, we knew what we had to do, but it was hard to realize it was going to happen tomorrow, you know. And young men like that, I don't think give it a great deal of thought anyway. I think we'd been so... propagandize, you know, we'd really in the wrong way that it just, we're going to do it.
Well, how did it go? I mean, take me from the ship on in.
Well, didn't go well at all. We load up in the landing crafts, packed in. And a few of us were in a different boat than the rest. And I remember my buddy and I had to, we had a 90-pound drum of wire between us.
Your buddy? Is this a personal friend?
Yeah, right. Eight of us were in this one boat.
Had you become close to some of these people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, we'd been together. Some of us had been together from day one in boot camp. We'd gone through boot camp together and into the same outfit. So we'd been together now, see, over 2 years.
So these were actually some of the closest friendships you'd ever had.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were, really. Mm-hmm. So we were very close, very close. And we'd trained together all these months. So we land on Iwo, and, well, it was volcanic ash. The beaches were, there was a steep cliff going down, and it was volcanic ash. And you step into it, and you go up to your knees, right out of the boat into the ash. And we were really catching fire everywhere.
Were there dead people?
Everywhere. Everywhere you looked, they were already just really.
Did you have a reaction to that?
Yeah, save your butt. You know, really, you react quickly.
Was it? I'm giving a leading question, but from the time that you were approaching the beachhead, when you hadn't actually seen that there was death involved in this, to the point where you saw your first bodies and actually hit it, was there a thing that you went through, a mental thing, a mental change?
I remember going in, we had to keep low in the boat. So we couldn't see the beach, couldn't actually see the beach going in until we hit it, because we were down. And when you hear, well, we had left the transport, and we pulled around the battleship Missouri to go in. And we got around the battleship and got very far past, and they opened up their 16-inch over us.
The Missouri did.
Yeah. Well, I knew then it was the real thing was happening. Well, when they started firing those big salvos over us, and then you could hear, you know, they had a big fleet, naval fleet, and they were shelling over us all the time. And I knew then it was for keeps. So we hit the beach, and the eight of us were to join our other group, which was close by. And when we hit the beach, a number of the fellows just froze. What do you do, boy? You know, where do you go?
Did they freeze upon seeing the dead or the devastation?
The devastation, yeah, and the shelling was so heavy, everywhere you'd look.
Did they freeze in the boat or after they got
out? After got out, I saw quickly that they were really, really shelling the beach, and my idea was to get off the beach.
The Japanese were shelling the
beach. Oh, yeah, yeah. And so this was rather it was a little cliff-like, about maybe 15, 20 feet high, coming right down to the water. So I said, let's go. So I took over the hill, the little cliff, and dropped in a hole, and nobody was there. They stayed. Well, I learned later that I had no sooner than dropped over the cliff, and one of my good friends that was supposed to have been with me caught a shrapnel and killed him there. And then I saw I was alone, and I was going to get off the beach. Something told me to get off the beach.
Something very wise.
Yeah, yeah. And so then I take off and run, you know, a few yards and drop into a shallow hole. And as soon as I dropped in, well, one of the sergeants from that we were to connect with saw me drop into this hole. And about that time, a big shell came on. And he thought I was dead. It was that close. He yelled.
What did he yell?
Bill. And he thought I'd caught it.
Now, were you friends with him?
Yeah. Yeah, see, we were, we knew, we'd been together so long, so we'd, you know, we'd really a bunch of people.
So you were all close then?
Yeah, very close. Uh-huh. And it was a bad day, and, well, and it was really so bad. After about the fifth wave, they stopped sending in troops.
Well, now, you say a wave. What's a wave? How many men would be in a wave?
Oh, a wave can be, a whole row of boats going in.
How many men would that be?
Oh, it can be several hundred.
At a time.
Yeah, because we were, our landing covered maybe 2 miles of beach. And these were ships, these little landing boats going in, you know, pretty close together, and taking in a slew of men. And they go in by waves, and they go out. Second wave and third wave and so forth.
Well, now you were in this hole and this shell just about got you. What happened after that?
Well, then I got with my with the other men in my outfit.
You stand up and walk over there?
No. You don't stand. You run low. You run low.
At this point, had you come to some kind of mental conclusion about what you were doing? I mean, when you get off that landing craft, you were still green.
Mm-hmm.
You were inexperienced. But by the time that you got out of that hole, did you have things pretty much in hand as to what was going on?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. This is why, I got off the beach, because this is where they were getting killed. Man, they were dying on that beach. And that's no place to be. Not only big shells and small shells. And see, we were close to Suribachi.
Suribachi was the large mountain.
Yeah, on the south end, big rock. And we were close to Suribachi. The machine gunners were getting us also. So we had machine guns. And
you were that close to Suribachi?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, we took Suribachi, my outfit.
Mm-hmm.
The fellows that raised the flag, one of them was attached to my outfit. So it was that close.
But you were actually within machine gun fire.
Yeah.
That would be, what, 1,000 meters or 2,000 meters?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Because the reason why I know we remember so vividly, one of our code talkers died of machine gun fire on the beach. 50 caliber, so caught him on the beach. So, see, we're that close.
That would be even longer range.
Mm-hmm. So we were machine gun and rocket and mortar fire. And something told me, you know, says move, keep going anyway, keep going. And then I joined up with the others in my outfit. So we immediately started setting up communication lines. And we got into communication. See, our job was stay in communication with the front lines. We handled all the front line communications. And
Well, did things get a lot easier from that point?
No. The rest of the, for about the first 3 days, it was, this first 3 days was just hell. They pounded the life out of us. And as I was saying a while ago, at the end of the fifth wave, they stopped sending in men because we just about got pushed off.
You mean the losses were so heavy?
Yeah, they just almost pushed us back in the water. And we just took it by sheer manpower, that's all. Just manpower. So we didn't have any new troops coming in for a long time. And we thought, well, you know, this is it, boy. But then they decided that we were going to stay, and we stayed.
You mean they put you on and more or less than sat back and
tried to
watch and see whether you could keep it?
Or we keep it.
But there was no out for the guys that were already on that beach.
No.
Once you got on that beach, you were going to stay there or die.
That's right.
I see.
So, and you hear, we had an old general, they called him Blood and Guts. You know, howling. Mad Smith was another one. You know, these old boys would howl. Blood and guts, but it was our blood and our guts, not his, that was at stake. So we kept it. We stayed on. And
did that change your life, that short experience?
Yeah. Yeah. Sure did. I don't think a man can go through that kind of stuff and never be the same.
What change did that make?
Well, I really developed, a nervous condition from the war. It really bothered me. I was not cut out for this kind of stuff. I know that, you know, I know that now, that I was not cut out for this. Killing and maiming and this type of thing, it was so against my nature. And then to do it, and then to suffer the consequences of, you know, shot nerves and bad stomachs and all these things come in, you know, came in later.
Now, you knew when you were on that beach, you knew that you could die at any second. How did you cope with that? Or did you cope?
You stay busy. Stay busy. I know. Soon after I hooked up with my outfit and we were in communication, then the word came to break down and move, so we were going to move a little ways. And so the warrant officer and I were to splice in lines. And he started splicing them in, and he was a little older. And he was so scared he couldn't splice the wires. You know, so shaking he couldn't splice. Well, man, because the sheriffs were everywhere. So he says, "Here, Bill." So I had to splice in. I think sometimes you're too green to be scared. Really, really too green. So I spliced in and we went up. And there was a hole, big shell hole, and a lot of people in it. So we dropped in there for just a minute. I said, "Let's go." Because, man, I could see quickly where they were shelling. Anywhere there were people, they were shelling. You get a bunch. And again, just got away from this place. And shell caught it. You know, it was just that way, hour after hour after hour. It's like you leave one spot and, man, a shell is there.
It's like you were one step ahead of the one coming after you.
Yeah, yeah, and this went on, you know, so long. And you don't know why these happen, but you're thankful that you are one step ahead. So out of this, all of this, you know, we lost a lot of people. A lot of people.